might be able to make it. And perhaps he'll join us as, you know, we move along. So I don't see any public dialed in. There is a spot here for public comment. So that I move to approval of minutes from the May 7th, 2021 meeting.
I move to approve those minutes.
Do we have a second?
Second.
I just moved
to
second.
There was one minor correction that Sherry's taken care of already.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, that it's been adopted. We have a number of discussion items here. Mike Merzinski, our finance director, had mentioned that he will have to sign off early. So if it's acceptable, if we can just move item 4D, I believe is what that was. No, 4C, excuse me. First, if that's okay.
Sure.
Mike, you're up. This would be the...
Yeah, you caught me with a mouthful of food. I'm sorry, I just out of a meeting, so I'm trying to eat. And that's why you don't see me. But yeah, I could do a quick update. Part of the meeting I just came out of was we're implementing a new online payment system called Invoice Cloud and Water Smart. Invoice Cloud, you'll be able to pay your utility bill, court fees, and one other, I went blank. But then we also, Water Smart will be able to update, or you'll be able to see your water consumption, your personal water consumption for all your accounts online. You can see your history, your bill history. So the only reason I'm giving that outline is because we're testing the court system as one of our first ones to take in online payments beyond utility billing and AR. And once we get that, we may start throwing the business license out there next year, and room tax maybe this year. But room tax is kind of still on course to be shifted to the state. We still want to do that that program, turn it over to the state for collections, very similar to our gas tax. So that was just a quick update for you guys. So I don't know if you have any questions. I guess.
Yes.
Okay. And that's all I have for you, Derek. I mean, we're still in the process of testing things. So we roll out the online system October 1st, and we'll probably bring in maybe room tax mid-year if we haven't turned it over to the state by that time. So that's where we are.
So presently, as you know, as you may all know, that when we're dealing with an intermediary like Airbnb, they pay lump sum for their room tax collections. And, you know, we know which units or grouping of units those payments are associated with, but we cannot tie those payments to a particular unit. You know, this unit made X payment. It's not provided that way. Airbnb has been reluctant to provide it in that manner. Apparently, the state and Airbnb have worked out and a deal where if the state's doing the collection, we will be able to, on our behalf, then we would be able to do that kind of individual unit audit.
Yep. Well, we'll see what we get from the state. So hopefully we'll get something from Airbnb.
Any sort of timeline from the state, or is that wishful thinking?
It's kind of wishful thing. It's dependent on my schedule and be able to pull it up from way down on the list to current activity. It's just good. And as Derek alluded to in his memo, we may need to change licensing requirements, but I'm not sure at this point. Nobody has gone with the state to do the room tax collection that I know of yet. So I don't know what that process.
Yeah, Mike, Depot Bay, I just read in the newspaper this week, they're changing their ordinances to comply with the state ordinance to go forward with state collection.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So, So that's the first one I've seen an yep. actual account of that's considering making the change. So
I might take a look at their setup. I think thanks for that.
Derek, I'm not sure if this is appropriate, but before Mike jumps off at some point yep. in the agenda, I wanted to see if we could talk about the renewal, the licensing renewal process paperwork wise. And so I don't know if you think we would need Mike for that discussion or not, and where on the agenda you guys would like to put that, but I'd like to add that in.
Okay, sure. You know, again, since you know, Mike's time is limited, and I think it would be prudent because on the renewals, that's a tag team effort between our department and the finance department. It'd be good if he could participate in that discussion. So we'll,
yeah, that'd be fine.
If it's amenable to the group, we'll just tackle that one right now as an agenda add for discussion.
Sure.
Okay.
The feedback from the short-term rental community that I've been asked to bring back to you guys is when it's time to renew the license, it seems like the process is just like starting out with a brand new fresh license. Not only do we all find the city's procedure to be a little bit antiquated to begin with the bless Kay's heart, with the goldenrod paper and the pink paper and the whole setup, but it sounds like, and I'm not involved in the day-to-day to this, but the feedback I'm hearing is that we're asked to fill out a very similar, real full packet for renewal. And so I said, I would bring to the group just a thought for you guys. Could the city consider streamlining the renewal process at some point? That's it.
Okay. I appreciate the feedback. Yes, there are elements that are labor intensive because believe me, you know, we feel mm-hmm. it on our end too, in terms of just processing everything. My hope is that some of this would be addressed with a shifting to an online format. One of the issues and the reasons why we ask people to provide detailed information annually is, as many of you know, and the issues that have come up in the past, short-term rental operators and owners aren't always punctual about updating the city with new information. And this is a way of ensuring that they have to think about that. And it's everything from who their designated contacts are to their insurance documents being refreshed. So I think we certainly might be able, if we go to an online, have them confirm that information, you know,
yeah.
where they have to, you know, that that's that is idea. Still accurate.
Yeah. Cool. I'll share that that the city's, you know, working on taking the whole procedure online, and to stay tuned for improvements.
Yeah.
The city's always looking to make those improvements and was
yep.
open-minded to the feedback. And then yep. I've done my due.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Mm-hmm.
The next item we had was an update on licensed short-term rentals, the cap, and the wait list. So I'm going to go ahead and do a share screen here, just kind of bring up the memo that you all have in your packet, if I could get to that real quick. All right, where are you? Give me a second here. There it is. So get panned down to it. I guess you can all see the memo there. So we have, you know, we have 191 licensed short-term rentals inside the city limits. You know, of that number, 145 are inside the overlay. 38 are outside the overlay, and 8 are B&Bs or home shares, which are not subject to the overlay. They can locate, you know, wherever inside the city limits. The 176 license cap that was established in 2019 only applies within the overlay, with the expectation that units outside the overlay will go away over time as owners choose to no longer use them. As short-term rentals, vacation rentals specifically, or they sell their property or something of that nature. So we do have some units that count against the cap number, even though they're not being actively used as short-term rentals. That's because those non-conforming units have to stay discontinued as rentals for a period of 12 months before they go away permanently. So didn't really see any change in terms of the number of short-term vacation rentals outside the overlay. That's more or less static from last year. Still down a little bit from what it was when the ordinance went into effect, from 45 down to 38. But we didn't really see much in the way of changes there. And we'll have 23 licenses inside the overlay for vacation rental dwellings that we can make available to those that are on the wait list. And we'll begin doing that shortly. And then it takes several months for a new short-term rental to go through the licensing and inspection program. So many of the people that would be, receiving this opportunity coming off the wait list, they'll be positioning their units for next summer season, primarily. Currently, we're at 78 properties on the wait list. That's higher than it was last time. I believe around 60 last time. So it's growing. So that puts us more in the 3 to 4 year window for somebody to work their way up from the bottom of the wait list. Now, remember, when we say 23 licenses are available, we'll go through more properties than that are on the wait list. We find that there are a significant number of people who are on the wait list that when we do get to them, they're not ready. Perhaps they have a long-term renter in there and they're comfortable with that for the time being. There are a number of reasons why they may or may not want to proceed. There are also some that would not be eligible because there's already a vacation rental building on the same street segment. Folks who sign up for the wait list are made aware of that, so they know that there's a possibility that when their name comes up, if there was already a vacation rental dwelling on the same street segment, that they wouldn't be eligible. We'd be skipping past them onto the next person. So our plan in the coming weeks is to begin working down that wait list. I think last year, which was our first year where we were working with the wait list, we vetted with you kind of the materials we would be sending out to folks. We'll be using that same approach this go around. I did include in your packet some maps, updated maps, just kind of showing the general distribution of vacation rental dwellings, the B&Bs and home shares. We're pretty much static with respect to B&Bs and home shares. Still 2 B&Bs, 6 licensed home shares in the city. Anybody have any questions relative to the wait list and number of licensed units, that kind of thing?
Hey, Derek, what are we doing if someone's on the wait list and they aren't ready? Do they retain their spot on the wait list or do they go to the bottom of the wait list?
Typically, we would I don't remember how we handled that. I believe they go down to the bottom of the wait list. Sherry's nodding her head, so we're in agreement. They go to the bottom of the wait list.
Correct.
Okay.
That's how we handled it in the past.
That feels right.
Right. How many have you done that to? I mean, where they've lost their place or just the ballpark figure?
Sure, was it about 7 or 8?
Yeah, that range? Sounds right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh.
That was with the first go around.
Yeah. Oh.
Any other, so we're seeing a slow uptick, and we'll keep you informed as that wait list continues to kind of grow in the manner in which it's growing. The council has the ability to adjust that cap up to 200 just by resolution if it wants to. can also adjust it down. I mean, it has the flexibility to go either way. Anything over 200 would have to be an ordinance amendment.
The Derek, the if the council can increase it to 200, is the 200 that just really the additional ones apply to the in the zone, or is that out of zone too?
No, it would be only in the permissible overlay, permissible area overlay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, our expectation outside the 38 that are remaining, that number will continue to slowly go down.
Right.
Over time. Any other comments?
No.
Oh, yeah. And Sandy, this is where we, you know, first pass through on the wait list. This little sheet here showed those that we were able to work through and get licensed off of the wait list and those that didn't proceed.
Huh. Okay.
So I'm going to move down to the next item, which would be the enforcement update. And Jim, do you want to go ahead and take it?
Sure. So take a look at it. It's been pretty light on complaints. We've only had 14 complaints. Some are actually duplicates. Wound up with only, I believe, three properties that are still open and under review. Everything else, majority of the complaints were they couldn't get into the unit or some other aspect of the unit that emergency contact was notified and they responded. A couple of the noise complaints, we were unable to verify that it occurred. And so we went ahead and closed them. We had quite a few, a little bit more than last time, number of complaints where the person remained anonymous or did not give us any contact information. We had one where Vacasa actually went in and kicked the renters out for violations. Two cease and desist letters that have gone out in the last 3 months, which will probably, at the end of this week, will go to citations. We had one citation letter issued, or one citation issued, and that's been pretty much it.
Hey, Jim, how are we responding to the complaints that we receive? Do we provide a response back for each complaint, or
when we
don't
have
we do that?
When we have complainant contact information, yes, we do. We try to get from them more details as far as the complaint goes, because Lodging Res only puts in so much. So we try and get a little more detail, and when we can move forward. I can say personally, quite a few of my inquiries never get replied. I never get a call back from the complainant or an email back saying, you know, this is the details of what's occurred. So a number of them just kind of run into a dead end.
And then again, if you do get a complaint, and you do you typically email them back, or do you call them back, or what's the process?
If there's an email provided, I like to do emails only because then I can allow them to go into a little more detail with their response as far as what occurred. Then mm-hmm. there's usually no miscommunication in somebody misunderstanding what I asked. Where there isn't an email, hopefully there's a phone number and I will contact them via phone.
And does our system require people to, or not require, but give them an opportunity to list phone and email when they make their complaints?
Yes.
Okay.
I would sure love us to start referring to these as like contacts to the 800 number and not complaints, because really we're talking about 14 contacts in 90 days, right? Mm-hmm. But did you say, Jim, two of them were people that were trying to reach their property manager because they were locked out or couldn't work the TV?
Yeah.
And I just want to make sure that we are keeping a really good track for the constituency of how many true complaints there really are, and then how many of them are often so unfounded. It's a technicality, but I just want to be on record as suggesting that just because of the contact through the system, it isn't a bona fide complaint. It was just somebody trying to reach.
I thought when we first started with lodging res, that came up as to whether we would call it a complaint or a contact. And there was, I can't remember the issue with lodging res where we had to list it as a complaint. I mean, we're going back a couple of years, so it's a little clouded as far as, but I remember that being brought up in one of our first meetings.
Okay.
What we have in terms of our online, I'm fairly certain our online form, that is an incident report. And so where we have it on our website for somebody to, you know, lodge a concern, it's framed as an incident report, not a complaint hotline.
I mean, we're trying
to be careful as we set up our end of it to not use that term per se. I do believe where Jim's coming at is that the company, which the public don't really see this, it's the back end, had to stay that way because it's used more universally by a number of different jurisdictions.
It all makes sense. And I don't mean to be splitting hairs. I think I mostly just want to be on record as saying and making sure that when we report back to the constituency that, you know, somebody that calls the city thinking that they're reaching, because we have the 24/7 number in the window, thinking that they're trying to reach their property manager, should in no way be construed as an issue or a problem. When we're measuring this, because as we look back on this, we see that these really just aren't that problematic as history is showing us now that we're tracking. So just wanted to be on record with the group as saying so.
I'm going to stop share for a moment. I had a email from Councillor Parker today regarding the property at 1330 Northwest Spring Street. It's a property that we've had some discussions about. That's one that had, I think, as of September of 2020, it had 17 complaints that had been filed, or incidents, excuse me. Two individuals had filed those, various issues. And he had inquired as to, you know, why they weren't picked up in the report that Jim had put together. And I noted that I went back into the system and there hasn't been a online submittal or hotline call on that property since September of 2020. You know, nonetheless, you know, Councillor Parker was, you know, in his email mentioned that he is having constituents contact him complaining about short-term rental use, in this case, in an accessory dwelling unit. As Jim, I shared those with you. I don't know if you had a chance to take a look at them, but I guess my question to you would be, how are you handling incidents that get reported to you outside of the online submittal form or hotline?
I haven't received any this last three-month period. When I do get them, I usually will try and create a catch screen through dispatch for an ordinance violation and then kind of pursue it from there, see what I can find out, see if there's any basis for the incident being reported, and kind of go from there. Now, after I received your email from Ryan, I went into Airbnb and VRBO and brought up the listings for the property in question, and all the listings that include the ADU, when you go to try and book that property, it shows a minimum 30-day rental. So anything involving that ADU, they're showing as a long-term rental. If somebody is renting it and then they wind up leaving after 10 days and the owner of that property gives them a credit for the other 20, I don't know. There's no way for us to really track that. other than us approaching the people renting them and asking for them to voluntarily tell us whether they're renting it less than 30 days and whether that was an agreement made between them and the registered owner, which a lot of people will not, when they see the police at their door or and they're being asked about their rental, they're not going to voluntarily give up a lot of information that if they think they're going to get in trouble.
Well, I guess my question to you, Jim, would be was less necessarily about that specific property, but do you get inquiries outside of the system, the lodging res system, and if so, how are those tracked? You know, because when I look at the memo, it's specific to what was, you know, incidents reported either through the online form or hotline. It doesn't list any other type of incident that may have been funneled through, say, an elected official who was contacted by a constituent, or if you were contacted directly outside the system. How are those handled, or how frequent are those?
They were more frequent when we first started with lodging revs. When we first came out with the email contact and the hotline, we had a few citizens who circumnavigated calling lodging revs and would contact Officer Ballantyne or I directly, and we would handle them just as we would any other complaint, being that there was no contacting of lodging revs, there was no record of it. So other than us saving emails, creating a cat screen through dispatch for an ordinance violation, that's really about the only way that we would track those. I have not received one outside of lodging revs probably within the last 6 months, maybe a year. I don't know if Officer Ballantyne has received any.
Would it be possible to just enter those ourselves into lodging revs just so that we can clearly track any of those very occasional sorts of complaints that come in a different direction?
I honestly don't know. I'm sure there should be a way for us to do it.
Because it would be nice to have that all consolidated in one report so that we can certainly represent this report as being the total, sure, you know, the total activities. But if we can pursue that, that might be a good idea. And it sounds like it's a fairly infrequent occurrence now. But yeah, it seems that we should be keeping these all together.
Okay.
Hey, Spencer, it seems like those two units on Spring Street are a continual problem. And I don't know how. I mean, we even heard that there was going to be a lawsuit about it, that the unit they built behind the existing one was also used as a vacation rental. And how do we control that somebody says they rent it for 30 days, but then they sub-rent it to somebody else or family members or something like that? How is that being recorded at all? How is this? How can we? I think that's probably what's happening there. Even though somebody rents it for 30 days, they sublet it to somebody else. So I know that particular unit in the rear has been, the rear unit, not the front unit, but the rear unit has been a continual problem because of the access to it and how the driveways and
right,
all the parking and everything is in there. Yeah,
and that's something I guess we've got to discuss a little further as far as what, if any, additional steps we can take. Right now it's being advertised for 30 days. You can't book it for less than 30 days on any of the other sites. Jim had indicated that earlier. It won't allow you to book for a week or 2 weeks or a weekend. So it's set up that way, because that would be a clear violation if it was allowing folks to book it for a period of time. There's a couple questions that come into play. Is if someone does stay less than 30 days, there's also kind of a room tax implication, we probably need to give a little thought to as well, if there's anything we can figure out on that issue, because again, if they go 30 days or more, there's no room tax.
Yeah, I understand applied. That, but we've had testimony at council level saying that there's cars coming and going there all the time, different people living there, even though it's a 30-day rental, different people seem to be occupying that rear unit and causing congestion in that neighborhood. So how's that being handled? I mean, how does that, as a city, how can we assure the neighborhood that it's being rented for 30 days and not sublet? Or is that even within our purview?
Well, it's a tricky issue to prove based on the information that we have. And I guess that's something internally we'd have to discuss a little further with city attorney to see how far we can go with that sort of an issue if we believe that there's this is a regular practice going on. You know, so that's something I think we can talk about internally. You know, I really don't have a better answer for you at this point than that. So I don't know, Derek or Jim or Jason, if you've got anything to add to that.
You're right. It's going to be extremely difficult to try and prove. I mean, we could get transient room tax records, I suppose, and if we can break it down as to how much they're paying per, you know, stay. But then you could have a person saying, yeah, I rented it for 35 days, but I had to leave after 10 days because of a medical emergency. Then we have to prove that a medical emergency occurred, and that's the reason they were able to cancel. It's going to be difficult. I mean, I'm sure we can maybe brainstorm a way that may give us a little more information and help us to try and track that.
Jim, can you tell me the last time you received any kind of inquiry on that property?
It's got to be a year.
That was the last time we had anything through lodging revs on that one. Dietmar, yeah. Was
and that's what
September
we had the
citations, of 2020.
Yeah, and questions about whether they had actually paid their business license renewal fees, and that was the last time anything ever got dealt with.
Where's Ryan coming from then, saying that people are calling him that with complaints about this particular unit being abused, the system being abused here?
I don't know.
Is that recent, or is that?
I don't know. And that's the thing too. And if they're just engaging a council member, and that's as far as they go. You know, we don't have that information. I mean, it's, you know, what we try to do here when we have people who have concerns is encourage them to use the online form or the hotline to get an incident reported so it's logged. But if they just reach out to a council member, we have no way of knowing, you know, when it occurred, how frequently there was an issue, any of that stuff.
Yeah, I think on that issue. Yeah, on that issue, I did speak with one of the neighbors just this past Friday. I think there was some frustration too that she felt that she wasn't getting a response back from what she plugged into lodging revs. But I think it's something we've got to discuss internally to kind of sort out exactly how we're handling that sort of situation. To figure is there a way to better address it than what we have, if there is an issue to address. You know, we have, you know, the different reports from the different sides, and that's where it always gets tricky to fully understand what's going on there. So
it seems like every time we get together, we talk about the unit on Spring Street not being a problematic, and I don't know why it always comes up as a prime example for how the system's being abused, but something has got to be going on. I don't know, or the neighbors are upset or something. I don't know how we find out, you know, but it seems like that's the only one in the city that really is continually problematic short-term rental.
There's a small number of them. That's one of them. I think at our last meeting, I put a little summary report together where we had the bulk of the incidents that were being reported by a small number of people, and they related to a small number of properties.
Yep. Can I just share some industry insider information, just food for thought to chomp on? Our program only manages 29-day or less rentals to one party or one person, right? The short-term rental industry is often blamed for second home owner home use, And when we overreach our regulations, not just in the city of Newport, but in other places, what we're caused, and I said this early on when I sat on the first committee, is you cause the activity to get pushed underground. But it's very legal. There's nothing that, and this has nothing to do with the Spring Street property, but there's what you're going to start seeing now is 4 and 5 families buying a second home. And they aren't going to be selling any nights. They're not going to be advertising, and they're not going to be exchanging any money. So they're just co-partners. And now all of a sudden, the city doesn't benefit from any transient lodging tax. None of these rules apply. And, you know, it's they're no different than any other homeowner. And we're starting to see this trend everywhere. And so I just think that, you know, we have to be really careful about that this ordinance, you know, pertains to stays of 29 days or less that are being sold, right? But that's, you're going to start seeing that. And the industry gets blamed, you know, for people that are using their second homes and, you know, don't follow any of these rules. Well, they don't have to, right? They can use their home any way they want to. So just want to share with you guys. This is definitely a huge trend. This is what's coming from all the overregulation across the entire U.S.
So what you're saying is that a home like the one on Spring Street could be incorporated into a company, and they could have like 50 owners, and they could all stay there at various times?
Well, any home, Dietmar, can be owned. You and I and Derek, yeah, and Spencer can all own a 1/4 interest in a home, any property, any investment. But if we were all buddies and we went in together on a vacation home, and then we split it up, you know, your family takes a quarter of the year, pick your weeks or whatever, and then you let your college kids come and use a week, and they don't have to keep their cars on site, and they don't have to limit how many people are in the house, right? They don't have to follow any of these rules. So that's what happens. That's what you're going to see stretching out of this, the government overreach that we're seeing across the U.S.
So are you saying that on top of the 4 people that own the home, they could let other people stay there too?
Sure. Can't you have any house guests in your home that you want to at any time?
But then doesn't that become a vacation rental of sorts?
No.
If no money's
only
exchanging
if you
funds.
Are exchanging funds, only right. If you are selling the nights for money for 29 days or less to one lessee or one party. So we see this, you know, we're working with this quite a bit, particularly in Bayshore right now, where the short-term rental industry is getting blamed for people that don't have short-term rentals, that neighbors perceive as short-term rentals, but just people using their secondary homes. So anyhow, don't want to go down a big rabbit hole, but, you know, that's, what we're being tasked with here is, are people misusing the properties under a 29 day or less program? That's what a short-term rental is, and that's what this ordinance is all about, right? So neighbors aren't going to like a lot of things that we all do as neighbors. And that one on Spring Street may or may not fall into that category. I don't know, but you can't tell somebody what to do with their home outside of this, you know, as long as they're within the zoning rights and outside of this program.
Just to follow up on what you've been saying, I can name 6 different friends that I have who are in ownership with 4 or 5 different people with one house, and that's exactly what they do. And this is all within Lincoln County.
Yeah. No, nobody can tell you how to take title to your property. So that's how people are going to get around this not being able to get a short-term rental license. They're just going to co-invest, and then we won't have any jurisdiction over it. And that's, in my opinion, that's the unfortunate fallout of over-regulation.
Interesting. Okay. Well, and you're saying that's a pattern that's happening now quite a bit?
It's been happening.
That's what people are going to do when they want to. You know, buy a home and they can't afford, you know, to have it sit, you know, vacant. So they're going to go in with partners, and then they're going to use it however they see fit. It's not a short-term rental, but you're still going to have transient activity, and we're not going to benefit from any of the taxes. and we're not going to be able to slap any of these rules and regs on them. And unfortunately, it's going to be disruptive. Neighbors are still going to find that disruptive, but we won't have this program, you know, to fall back on. So that's why my advice has always been all along, let's come up with some really good neighbor policies and the mediation program between neighbors and so forth, but to be thoughtful about how we're regulating. But anyhow, that's a big trend that's going on out there. So we're going to see that for sure in Newport.
I mean, that's timeshare. I mean, that's really what it is.
Yeah.
It's
not time, it's real estate. I mean, the difference is that it's real estate, not time.
But fair. It's moving in that direction. And especially if you got into a large number of persons who own a percentage share of a particular unit. I would say the kicker, and we have run into this though, is folks, even if they're in that kind of arrangement, that does not allow them to go on Airbnb and say, we want to let some other person rent a 2-week block that's available because none of the owners can use the unit.
No, then they would be breaking this ordinance. Right. And they would, absolutely.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Hey, Derek.
Yes.
Thank you. Regarding the Spring Street, like Jim said, we haven't been any complaints for over a year. And whether they're in compliance or the neighbors stopped calling, I couldn't tell you, but I do know that here a year and a half ago, when we had a lot of complaints, Jim went there, Jovita went there, I even went there. I know one of the times we learned that a family had out of, I think, Washington had rented it, and it was for the entire family, and they all took turns. And so they rented it for the entire month, and a different section of family came down every once in a while. They'd overlap maybe by a day, completely legal. You know, it was, whether it's occupied by the person renting it or family or a guest, there's no other money exchanging hands, you know, that we're able to prove. And so that's difficult. You know, when the different cars are coming and going, and when you try to explain that to the people that call, I get on face value, it looks like there's 25 different people coming in there. And there might be, but it's still only one rental check. There's one rental agreement. And if the host of that or the owner in their contracts allows them to have whoever, like Jamie said, we can't control who you have at your house. And a lot of that's how we ran into it. And whether you call that circumventing the system, finding a loophole, or just going with their legal right, you know, we ran out of, because I know we did have some enforcement. Jim did identify some violations. And after some quite a bit of back and forth, it was ultimately remedied. And Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, but they are fully in compliance now.
Yes, from everything we can see.
Right. And so, you know, and we get these other complaints, and it's the same. It's the eye of the beholder. I think this is what's going on. Jim does, you know, spends a lot of time and spend an entire shift to determine there is no violation.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're the homeowner, you don't want to get a ticket based on a neighbor say so. You want it based on evidence. And sometimes we can't prove one way or another.
So, be curious to know whether they're renting it based on a monthly rental or a daily rental, even if they rent it for a month. I don't know whether you can ever get into that.
No.
So Dietmar, you anything less than, so whether it's one night, two nights, five nights, 14 nights, or 29 nights, that's a short-term rental. It requires a license. 30 nights or more, whether somebody stays there the whole time or not, or whether, like Jason said, they share it and say, you know, you come next week, I'll come next week, but they're not. It's a sticky wicket, and I'm telling you guys, this is what's going to happen, and we won't have any.
I'm sure there's some backdoor money changing hands. I don't see one person putting the bill for a total family. You know, I just don't understand that concept. I'm sure there's some family money changing hands.
When I was a little girl growing up in Southern California, my parents used to rent a condo in Palm Springs for like 90 days. And we would come and go every week, every weekend. Then we would have friends come, then we would have friends go, then we would have a holiday, then we, you know.
I'm going to propose that to my brother, saying, hey, you know, go rent a place over in Mount Hood and just let me stay there for a couple of weeks. I'll see how that goes over. Yeah.
Depends on family relationships. Yeah. Just on this whole issue, just to be transparent about this, this is still an issue with the property owners, this particular unit. And there's been unhappiness, I think, in the mechanism for enforcement on this. And that's something that I'm working with. I had a meeting with one of the property owners last week on this, and I've indicated that I'll get a report back to them on this, and I'll certainly share that with the committee as well. But I think the issue of making complaints and then never hearing an outcome is one of the things I heard during the meeting that I had with them. But I want to talk to Jim and Jason about that a little more detail so that I can get a response back to kind of close out a concern that's been given to me to work on. So
one other question I have is, I came in late. I'm sorry I was in the meeting. Did you give a report on how much fall off there was in the outside of the district previous to me coming in, Derek?
Yes. Yeah, it's actually static. So we're at 38. So
we're still at 38. Okay.
Yeah, we were at 45 when the program started. So that's where we're at.
So we're down 7, 8.
Yeah, 7.
Well, plus we're down in the district as well. There's if you look in your packet, there's a detailed report on the numbers that you can take a peek at. So.
So on the, just to wrap up the enforcement stuff, one thing we'll double back on too is that issue of making sure where we're aware that an incident's been reported to get that reflected in our reporting. And then I would just, encourage, DMAR, to the extent that we can, all of the council members can encourage folks to utilize those systems. That would be helpful because if they raise an issue to you, but it never gets back to us, we there's not much we can do.
I haven't received any phone calls or complaints from anybody about short-term rentals.
Okay.
For a long, long time. I mean, the Spring Street one was one that he was calling everybody there for a while. But other than that, I don't think there was much concern, really.
I was using you as the one city councilor in the meeting.
Okay. Well, I will do my utmost to let you know, Derek, if I get a complaint. Okay. You'll be the first to know.
With enforcement, there are three additional I want to just touch on lodging revs. That platform has been purchased by GovOS. That's not uncommon in the industry, and they did meet with us. They're all of the same staff are there. The same platform is there. It's going to be part of GovOS's suite of different services they offer government entities. There were three enhancements. I did want to talk to you about them because there's pros and cons with a couple of them. So one is we can do a automated complaint confirmation email that says your complaint's been received and here's your complaint number. I mean, that's basically kind of what you could do. And you could do something similar with complaint resolution, complaint number, blah, 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 or incident number, blah, 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 has been closed. And so those can be done in an automated way. So I guess the question is, do you see value in doing those? Right now, the number of incidents seems small enough that having a response from a city code enforcement officer or CSO is working. I would think that if it was a higher volume, you'd want to go the automated route, but we could still nonetheless do that if you see value there. Of the two, I would say the confirmation email would be the one that's probably a little bit more valuable. One would hope that when an incident's being closed, we would have reached out to the complainant already. And so there's really not a need for an automated, it's now been closed, but would appreciate your thoughts.
I'm not sure, and again, the number of complaints that we've had in have been fairly minimal, but I'm not sure that, certainly in conversations I've had, that everyone feels that we're, they know when these things are closed out.
Okay.
So I don't know, Jim, do you notify them when they're closed out?
The, like the ones listed that are not complaints, like person being locked out, where lodging reps has showed that, you know, the emergency contact was notified, they resolved the situation. No, I do not, I close them out, but I do not contact the complainant because there's actually not a complaint involved. The ones that are still open, I have, or under review, I believe on each one I've sent an email or called them to say that we are working on trying to get a resolution to the issue.
So where it's real, you're reaching out. Where it's not, you're just letting those go and closing them out.
And the majority of the ones that we close is where there's no violation involved, or it's somebody calling up to say, you know, oh, you know, the sink overflowed,
right,
or something. I don't see the value in contacting the complainant and say, you know, oh, this wasn't a violation, so we're closing it. Like I said, the ones that are under review are open. I believe I've contacted all those complainants involved and told them that we're looking into this. We're waiting for a call back from Vacasa or Meredith Lodging. We're trying to get all the information together.
But once you have that information and you close it out, either there was a violation or there wasn't a violation, do they get notification, the complainant get notification of how that ended up?
In the past, the ones that I wound up that were under review that I did close, I do believe I've contacted all the complainants, at least sent an email if I had an email address to let them know what the resolution was.
Okay.
Thoughts on those two? I mean, we could certainly implement them if you would like. There's no additional charge to the city.
Well, with the low volume, I don't know. Is this something that would make the job easier and better, or add another layer of inputting information?
Well, I think a couple concerns that I've heard off and on is with the automated system, people make the complaint, but there's not. I thought I remember hearing, and we haven't had many complaints, which is good. But I thought I remember hearing people weren't sure whether the complaint went through or not. So it seems that the confirmation of them filing the complaint would be a useful document so that they know that the complaint actually made it through. Because I know even with our website email addresses, sometimes people, I'll get something twice because they weren't sure the first one went through. And so to me, it's kind of a nice verification for the person making the complaint that it did get received by lodging revs. So,
well, that's, I agree with that. And it's similar to what the doctors do now with all online, and they confirm your appointment.
Yeah, or a hotel reservation. When you get the reservation confirmation email right back to you, it just seems like a logical thing to do, especially if there's no cost to it. So.
One of the things to consider is we have yet to have a normal summer season since we've implemented the lodging revs in that, because we started it at September of 1999 and 2019. I'm dating myself.
I'm going to put on my raspberry beret.
Hey, Jim, it feels like that, though.
Yeah, exactly. And then This summer season, I don't think can be called what we would think of as a normal tourist season for Newport. 2020, we know, was a wash. So maybe having these in place for next summer, when probably there will be an uptick in issues that people have, maybe it's beneficial to put it in place now.
I agree.
This is not an incredible amount of work here. All we need to do is come up with some verbiage that we're going to want to do. So in other words, you know, yes, to confirm that your incident report was received, here's your incident number. You can expect that it'll be reviewed within the next, three business days or something to that effect.
Yeah.
So that you said they have, that's not a problem. And you can come up with similar language for complaint resolution. You know, the complaint's been closed. I don't know, though, that that feature will provide an explanation as to how it was resolved. It may just simply be that they're informed that the incident's been closed and we're no longer pursuing it. But it could be a catalyst if they still feel that there, you know, is an ongoing issue. That might be something that triggers them to contact us again if they feel like there's still stuff.
I think a lot of people just wonder, was this resolved or wasn't it resolved, or is it still being investigated? You know, so I think having that closure might be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's fair. We can certainly pursue that. I would add, and I think we've all discussed this too, though, that sometimes it's not that they didn't get the response. They just didn't like the response that they got.
Right.
And so I think we do need to keep that in mind, that's a lot of it too, is that, you know, they didn't like the response, not that there wasn't a response.
Yeah, it's easier to deal with that than dealing with the question of how did this thing get wrapped up? So at least
sure.
Kind of that trigger point that says, hey, we're done with it. And they know we're done with it. And if they aren't happy with that, they know how to get a hold of us. So
there's nothing. Okay, so we'll go ahead and get that going. I'll work with Jim, Jason. We'll need to put our heads together just to make sure, you know, everybody's comfortable with the verbiage. Hotline recordings is just, we now have those. So if somebody lodges an incident via the hotline number, we have a recording of what was said between that person and the, you know, the third party who's handling the 24/7 hotline. So we have that available. So if at any point in time there's an incident where a hotline was involved and there's some question as to the nature of the incident being reported or how it was handled by the person who received that call, we have that information, can make that available. So just to know. That's all I had on the enforcement update. The only other item we have on the agenda is implementation of the STR licensing inspection enforcement program, which was just kind of how much time does it take for us to do this work? John had asked for that originally, and this is what we were able to put together for you. It's a little one-page memo that I have. I'm going to go ahead and pop it up on a shared screen. Pan down to it. So the time commitment for us, you know, it varies depending upon whether or not we are in application/renewal season or not. The biggest impact is on our administrative staff in both our department here at Community Development and then the finance department. So principally that's Sherry and Kay, who are, you know, investing a considerable amount of time during the license renewal period. And then in that period where we're reaching out to folks and help, you know, coming off the wait list so they can get licensed, that would be your kind of open license season. And then during what's framed here is kind of the off season, the January to June, it's a little bit more limited on administrative staff. Now, I don't know that picks up every call we get about short-term rentals. We get calls about all kinds of land use stuff. And, you know, we get regular calls about whether or not short-term rentals are permissible or not. You know, some of that, you know, it might get captured in here. I don't know that all of that is, but I don't know that that's all that big a deal because, you know, that's part of what we do just in terms of general public service. But, you know, the tasks outlined kind of show you, you know, what all is involved with those license renewal periods and the open license period. There's quite a bit of work on just, you know, getting the applications in, making sure we have all of the information, verifying that the insurance documents are correct. For new rentals, we have that inspection program, you know, where our building official and fire marshal are going through the unit. We're making sure that any structural deficiencies or issues with the unit are addressed. You know, we did pick up, you know, time coordinating with CSO as well. as far as code enforcement is concerned, and I talked to Jason about this, and please feel free to chime in if you have any additional thoughts. You know, his view on that was that when this program fired up after it was adopted in 2019, it was close to a full FTE of their folks that were engaged in addressing enforcement issues, but that demand's dropped down now to a half-time equivalency, which is what the position's budgeted. And then for oversight, and I think this is comparable for both Jason and myself, we're in the 10 to 15% range, you know, where we're involved either problem solving certain site-specific issues or fielding inquiries or coordinating with policymakers, holding meetings such as this, that kind of thing.
Thank you, Derek. That really lays it out. It's easy to understand.
I think any permitting program we have has an impact, you know, and at this juncture, I would say it's manageable, but it is taxing during that license renewal period, given that we do have limited staff. Anything else on this item? I'm sure John will weigh in writing, if which case we could pick it up at the next meeting if he has some other issues he's interested in discussing or, you know, wants us to provide to the group. That's all I had on the formal agenda. Were there any other items for the good of the order?
Just a general question with the lodging revs, and this is for Jim. How is it working as far as identifying unlicensed facilities? Are we finding some occasional unlicensed facilities?
They're pretty good. They check twice a week still. Some of them occasionally they miss one or two, which. I would say maybe once every quarter they might miss a property. And that could just be, I'm not exactly sure what the issue is there, but I have identified in all the properties I've gone after and sent cease and desist letters to easily probably 95% they've identified, and I've identified just through putting boots to the ground the other 5%.
And so that's been a fairly effective tool then?
I believe so.
Yeah, good.
Anything else? Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to see y'all.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.